I will say I'm very honored and pleased to be with you all. I worked in this building 30 years ago up on the 11th floor as a seminar designer for United Methodist Seminars on National and International Affairs. And young people from all across our denomination would come here for 2 to 4 day seminars to try to look at crucial public policy issues through the eyes of their faith. In those days, the wars in Central America, the East-West tensions, the nuclear arms race, hunger and poverty were the bulk of our seminars. It was a great, great opportunity and experience to be here, and I always enjoy coming back. As I look back on my life, I feel I've been involved in the intersection of faith and global community for many years. First at the Pacific Conference of Churches, headquartered in Fiji, where I studied the impact of multinational corporations on the people, nations, and churches of the South Pacific. Then at the International Public Policy Office of the United Methodist Church, where we attempted to stop the invasion of Iraq, and we worked for economic and environmental justice. And now at the National Council of Churches, where we publish the Bible, oversee faith and order discussions, and work for peace through interreligious relationships. It's an honor to be here with you. I always feel safe when I am in the company of either the current or the former Archbishop of Canterbury. I'll tell you why. Last year, I was a part of a group of discussion of a group of religious leaders, the possibility of going to northern Iraq in the midst of the violence that was taking place, so that we could try to stand in solidarity with Christians who are experiencing persecution. One of the people who was to be on that delegation was the Archbishop of Canterbury. My wife was petrified at the idea that I was going to be going into this war zone, and I said, I will stay as close as physically possible to the Archbishop, because no one will want him to be hurt. They won't be so concerned about me, but he'll be safe, so I'll be with him. So we have Lord Carey here, the 103rd Archbishop of Canterbury, and we are all, therefore, in safe and good hands. And Dr. Diop is a distinguished leader in the Seventh-day Adventist denomination, has been the former representative of that denomination here at the United Nations, and has spent many years at the forefront of this topic, faith and global community. And so would you welcome him as he opens our panel today.
Good afternoon to everyone. It's an honor to be invited to share this panel with these distinguished persons and with all of you. I wanted to really be gracious to you this afternoon. That is the only reason why I use a PowerPoint presentation, because I wanted to help you get over my unique accent. I thought that it would be easier if you would read at the same time what I'm saying, right? Is that so? Thank you very much for this privilege to share with you on the topic intersections of religion and worldviews in the secular space, exploring the promise of sharing religious values. What we were asked to talk about is very clearly stated in the program. How can faith be communicated effectively in a non-religious space? What is the best way to work with like-minded organizations to support peace, justice, and human rights? And then we were told that our closing presentation discussion will focus on the intersection of religion and the secular world, especially in the UN setting, and the importance of protecting both religion, freedom of religion, and free expression of religion. So that is the task before me. Now, the fundamental presupposition of the following reflections is that religion communicators offer valuable resources to the international community. The resources offered are not only relevant, actually they are needed. Now, how can I say that? In which context? The global community faces what one could term a multifaceted crisis of meaning. A wind of despair, I must say, spreads among radicalized individuals and organizations who have lost the sacredness of every person's life. Indiscriminate killings are justified by means of a morbid hope to receive recompense in the afterlife. That motivates suicide bombers eager to murder. This is indeed a despair, covered with the garb of hope for a better fate in an afterlife. But even though it may appear benign, the fragmentation of the human family leading to place national interests above universal common good, I think this state of international affairs shows the need for a religious discourse drawing from a sense of oneness and unity of the human family, a sort of spiritual framework of inclusive values shared by all the members of humankind. People can believe differently, but share deep values all members of the human family can ratify. I think this is one of the presuppositions of my presentation. Believing differently, but sharing deep common values that are essential for the survival of our humanity. Now, to participate in the global conversation and decision-making for the building of better relations among all nations and all people of goodwill is a responsibility and a right of every thoughtful person. Beyond government's engagement and international organizations' engagement to promote, beyond government engagement to promote their national interest, there are persons of goodwill, people dedicated to the well-being of the human family, irrespective of nationality or ethnicity. All people of different faith or of no religious persuasion should be welcomed to contribute to the world of ideas for the sake of finding creative means to better living conditions of brothers and sisters in humanity. To foster peaceful coexistence and harmony among human beings is a serious task. No dimension of human experience should be discarded. The international community has sensed such need and urgency by coming together to a unique platform, probably the most significant forum for such endeavors to bring the human family together is that of the United Nations, its systems and mechanisms. This is the forum where agreements, covenants, treaties are ratified by various stakeholders having in common the desire to improve the conditions of living of the whole human family. What lies at the deeper level, though, of these collaborations and partnerships are universal values which transcend national and tribal interests. I perceive as core among the goals and objectives of this worthy organization, I'm thinking about the RCC, the commitment to communicate with our contemporaries, to share one's religious worldviews and values, and I insist, without coercion or manipulation, and without instrumentalization of fellow human beings. Rather, the respect of other people's dignity, freedom of thought, conscience, choice, religion, or belief motivates its members. I would like to postulate at the onset that the most promising way to engage fellow human beings is through the forum of values. In our incontrovertible interactions with human beings of all walks of life, are values we hold dear and are willing to share. Universal values undergird the discourse and work to promote and to protect human rights. These values are not the monopole of any civilization, culture, or religion. Precisely, they are universal in nature. They intersect at the world of religions and world philosophies. They are indeed intersections of values, and even more fundamentally, they are principles that can function as overlapping normative consensus. Such principles can be seen in the concept, for example, of human dignity. The very foundation, the ground upon which universal values stand, is human dignity. This latter is recognized not only as a value, by the way, to be ranked among other values, but a principle which undergirds all universal values. Not only every major religious tradition posits the critical importance of upholding human dignity, the same conviction appears in secular moral philosophy. This is why people talk about overlapping normative consensus. Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative is an example of such a principle that seems to draw near consensus in moral philosophy. The concept of moral imperatives has gained acceptance in recent years in global consciousness. This is probably so because the horrors of wars, genocides, conquests, and imperialisms have brought to the front the need to agree on moral standards and norms that allow human beings to live together and share the public space. These agreed moral standards are necessary, by the way, for mediations in international, inter-ethnic, and inter-relational conflicts. Theodor Adorno, in Negative Dialectics, wrote that Hitler has compelled humanity to accept a new categorical imperative: orient our thinking and acting so that Auschwitz would never repeat itself, so that nothing similar would occur. To delineate moral or categorical imperatives, religious ideals and values are invaluable resources. The world would be deprived of essential resources for life's meaning and foundations which inform and form moral standards if the religious dimension of human experience is neglected. The space the United Nations offer to the whole human family benefits from the presence, input, and contributions of religion-based organizations. They enrich the world of values the edifice of the United Nations is based upon. The pillars of the UN are most certainly indicators of values the international community has by and large agreed to work on: peace and security, justice, development, human rights in terms of individual liberty, personal equality, and life and dignity, which, as I has reminded us earlier, the concept of individual liberty, by the way, presupposes freedom from want, freedom from fear, and freedom to live decently. It is not a coincidence that the UN Secretary General framed his report about the SDGs with the metaphor of a road to dignity. One can make a case that all the three pillars of the UN edifice are sustained on the foundation of human dignity. Whether, by the way, this dignity is understood as stemming from the belief in an eternal soul inherent in every human person, or whether it is grounded on the belief that humans are created in the image of God, or whether it is justified on the basis of the rationality that distinguishes human beings, its importance is nonetheless emphasized in various ways, and that matters. So religious freedom, or freedom of religion or belief, is one of the tangible expressions of human dignity. It is one of the fundamental freedoms which seems to undergird all the other freedoms. It is in itself a compound freedom central to all the others. As a matter of fact, religious freedom is the right to profess, practice, propagate, without coercion, intimidation, or force, one's beliefs. It is connected to the most intimate freedom, which is freedom of conscience. To illustrate this, let me quote the following. Religious freedom is the sine qua non of living freely. You may allow me to vote, own property, and associate freely in the public square in every other way. But if you do not permit me to speak or to act on those beliefs about ultimate reality that define who I am and why I am on this earth, then the other freedoms mean little. In a very real sense, then, all human freedoms depend on the freedom of religion. As such, religious freedom is the prerequisite for and the guardian of all other freedoms. It would not be far-fetched, therefore, to include freedom of religion or belief among the moral imperatives. in light of the fact that this freedom contributes to what it means to be a person. For our purpose, though, in this convention, suffice it to specify that freedom of religion or belief secures for everyone a place at the table, so to speak. Religious freedom, which is also freedom not to believe or to belong to any given religion, allows everyone the opportunity to be an influence in the political processes or in policy making without succumbing to the temptation of attempting to translate and impose personal beliefs into national or universal policies. The concept of separation of church and state and that of laïcité, by the way, as a political model of not privileging any given religion or faith-based organization has functioned as an antidote against religious totalitarianism. Religious dimension and discourse belong to the table of peoples and nations. And that is why this organization exists, I believe. Religious communication is at its best when it is informed by the reality of human dignity. That is, when it deliberately avoids violence, desists from coercion, force, intimidation, fear tactics, or the indignity of shouting at people, even and especially if it is in the name of God. History shows that God can be used as a disguise for paternalistic, infantilizing, and insulting practices which demean the dignity of others. What can communicators of religious values and principles legitimately bring to the international diverse and open forum? How can religiously minded people be relevant where no religious tradition is normative in its private claims to universal relevance? Good question. To maintain religious discourse and values and engage fellow human beings in a secular public space, one has to surmount several hurdles. Irresponsible freedom of speech has been used as a weapon. As you know, one can kill with one's tongue or pen. In the quest of the healing of the wounds of human existence, a deeper approach to communicating with others is needed. The humility of giving up totalitarian language, desisting from demeaning others, renouncing verbal or physical violence against fellow human beings is essential. Coercive language and discourse, harmful and demeaning speech, should not see the day among religion communicators. Because of the abysmal record of religious wars and religious conquests, a different perception of religion is needed today, one that can contribute to heal not only private human brokenness, but also collective relational peace. Religious communicators can live up to the core objective of several religions. What is that? The claim to offer life, freedom, and peace. Covenant with people implies the freedom to choose. Without freedom and voluntary commitment, there can be no genuine covenant. This is also true regarding any social contract. Fundamentally, in another sphere, economically in particular, there are only two ways of coordinating the economic activities of millions, it was said. One is central direction involving the use of coercion, the technique of the army, and of modern totalitarian state. The other is voluntary cooperation of individuals, the technique of the marketplace. Now, what is at stake in the above quotation is how one conceives human nature. A negative view of human nature has led the people throughout history to postulate that human beings must be controlled, their activities monitored, their relationships strictly regulated by means of centralized code of conduct. Religious people from all religions, without exception, have to overcome the reputation of having bought into this negative view of humankind. Obviously, secular ideologies also have had their share in stifling individual liberties. Religion is supposed to be liberating. Religion communicators have a heuristic partner, though, today, in the United Nations system and mechanism, especially regarding its overarching goal, the development and implementation of a culture of human rights. The discourse of human rights inevitably, and this is good, contributes to erode the foundations for totalitarianism. The third pillar of the UN indeed focuses on human rights in terms of freedom from want, fear, and freedom to live in dignity. These rights are concretely expressed in terms of emancipation, self-determination, and ownership of crucial decisions about one's destiny. Religion communicators offering and sharing religious discourse is incontrovertible if human beings are to be whole, benefiting and fully fulfilling the potential of all our dimensions, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, and social. The spiritual or religious aspect of human experience cannot be stifled without completely losing a key foundation of the global community's values and principles for meaning coexistence. Human search for ultimate meaning, to paraphrase the words of Viktor Frankl, is an incontrovertible and essential ingredient for what it means to be human and to be part of the international community where people of different beliefs but common values can build, enhance, and contribute to the betterment of one another's humanity. Values are not just spoken about, though. They are also to be embodied. The discourse of religion communicators gained to be expressed in lifestyle, in how we relate and treat people. Credibility of religious values is at stake. This is where one can cry out, "Who is sufficient for these things?" Thanks be to God who produces the fruit of His Spirit in us in terms of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. These fruit and values are our best contributions for the benefit of the whole human family. Thank you.
Well, I've nothing but admiration for that presentation, and I can't possibly disagree with anything you said, Gary. I just want to say I will be echoing a great deal of what, in fact, you have said in that very splendid expression of what we all hope, believe in, but fall very short of. In fact, actually, perhaps I need to pick up from what you said at the very end. The credibility of what we stand for is at stake today. But let me say a little bit about myself by way of introduction. I was Archbishop of Canterbury from 1991 to 2002. It was a very important decade. There was the ordination of women in my church. So much was going on. I was the first Archbishop of Canterbury to really grasp the issues of interfaith collaboration, not that others, my predecessors, were unwilling, nothing like that. Suddenly it became a very urgent matter in the Anglican Communion and in England in particular, and I could since spend a lot of time on that. It ended that period with two amazing, sobering things. One, of course, was 9/11, and I led a national service 4 days after that event in St. Paul's Cathedral. But the other thing in the year 2002 was to be asked by Shimon Peres to do a particular work in trying to bring together the religious leaders of the Holy Land. The ironic thing, we couldn't meet in the Holy Land. We had to go to Alexandria to do the job. The second thing is that it was in my time as Archbishop of Canterbury that Jim Wolferson, the president of the World Bank, asked to see me, because he had found out that actually the religious communities were doing so much around the world, and he began to question, are we giving the money to the right people? The World Bank is, of course, the bank of the nations of the world. Money is given to the governments, but the religions were doing so much that he said, we must start to negotiate. And there's a big story behind that. It started the World Faith for Development and Dialogue that Catherine Marshall is the CEO, and she's splendid, and she's here this afternoon. And we're doing, we believe, a very effective job in a small way because, like everyone else, we need more money to be more effective. And then the third thing I stand for is that during my period, I came across Dr. Handa, an amazing Shinto priest, businessman, philanthropist, polymath, you name it, he's it. And we work very closely together. And Midori Miyosaki is over there when taking a photo of me, which he shouldn't be doing. But and as Bud said, we're trying to develop the International Shinto Foundation. As a Christian, I'm delighted to support that work, and we need new colleagues to help us. I want to then add a few remarks to pick up some of the points that Ganoon spoke about just a moment ago. We live in a beautiful world, and let's all, whatever religions, focus on that. The word secular is not a bad word. That is the word really running through this session. Is it our enemy or is it our friend? Is this world not beautiful, so much music and dancing and happiness? But the other side is it's a fragmented, tortured, fractured world in which there's so much poverty, so much distress, so much violence, so much war. And here we are at work in this. I want to point out what an amazing job the religions do. We may get a very bad press, but in fact, anyone, a well-intentioned person who does a work and look at it, any religious communities will find the networks, all the good things that sociologists talk about as social capital. So many things are going on in the name of faith. But we're living in a very difficult time in which many people, and especially in the Western world, and particularly in Europe, Europe is quite an exception. Where the rest of the world is perhaps becoming more religious, Europe, Western Europe particularly, is becoming far more secular in a negative way. And you've only got to think of the new atheists, such as Richard Dawkins, and Sam Harris from this country, who are proposing the end of all religions because we are in the way. We're in the way of growth and so on. We have a battle, not in the sense of war, but in the sense of ideas that we have to contend. So on the one hand, we have a story of success in all our faiths of trying to deepen relationships and all the kinds of things that you were saying, Ganoon, a moment ago, building up freedom to believe and express and to believe differently, and yet this goes against so much as happening in the Western world where religion is seen part of the problem, if not all of the problem. So what does this require from us all? I want to make a number of assertions in order to get a discussion going. I think one of the things I want to say, it does actually require from us a degree of humility, a great deal of humility, if in fact, because in this world of competition and so on, we've got to be very careful about our absolutisms. I believe in Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life. You may believe differently, but each one of us actually got to approach this with a very strong sense of humility as well as hope as well. In what way can I express my faith in a world where there's so many different voices being raised, where voices we have to respect? And in this respecting of different voices, how can I express my faith so it becomes a voice of moderation and peace and hope, as well as a witness calling people to our faith as well? And this is the context, you see, in which we are striving to live today. Religion can be divided into good religion and bad religion. We know all about bad religion. It's happening in the Middle East at the present moment. In Palmyra, they found 40 graves mainly women and children, some beheaded. Now, IS is giving Islam a really bad name, and I can understand my Muslim friends saying, don't associate Islam with crimes, Islamic terrorism. And I can understand the saying, take that word away. There's nothing Islamic about that. Sadly, the word has stuck. But instead of actually all of us distancing ourselves from Muslim brothers and sisters, maybe this gives us an opportunity to pick up what you said this morning in your address about deepening relationships. How can we show our, not only our conviviality, but our friendship, awareness that we actually, when we talk about God, we're using same words, we are using similar expressions, our aims are very similar as well. And so we are, I think, incumbent upon each one of us to find new ways in which we can befriend one another and associate with one another. I want to actually then take up a second thing, which is to do with what we do with the public square in which we exist, whether we're Jews or Muslims or Shinto or whatever we are. Let me give an illustration of what it requires from us, because we are working in the same public space, and it is therefore important that all of us should understand that when we are having this discourse in the public space, we have to be careful of the kind of words we use and the language we use. Let me give an illustration from my successor, Rowan Williams, a well-known intellectual and indeed, from a Christian perspective, an academic giant. But some years ago, he made a call that it's time for United Kingdom law to take into account Sharia law. And there was a tremendous uproar about that, which I think everyone will remember. I think Rowan, being a deep thinker, had dimensions of this that maybe ordinary mortals couldn't pick up. But everyone assumed immediately that he meant that in the one nation, you're going to have civic law on the one hand and Sharia law on the other. And so everyone excoriated him for this idea and agreed that actually that simply would not work. You can't have a nation where two laws are parallel or three laws. It's got to be one law, one civic law, a law that stems from Christianity, yes, the Enlightenment, from Greek philosophy, from all, and from the United Nations articulated that as well. And that moment passed over, I think, with an awareness that if we're going to live in one community, there's got to be one law that binds us and holds us together. So the point I want to make is that religious practices are being challenged and to some degree limited by the wider context in which we work. Secondly, I've already mentioned the context in which we're working here, but I want to go back to the point I made earlier about the contribution that religious communities are really making, and which is often ignored, especially by those who believe that religion is the problem. By the way, on that issue, Karen Armstrong's book, The Killing Fields, is tremendously useful, because she shows very overwhelmingly, actually, that far from religion being the cause of conflict, in fact, when you look at the last century, the most warlike of all the centuries has been communism, it's been other things as well that's been at the very heart of that. I mentioned that it was actually Jim Wolferson's discovery as a president of the World Bank about the contribution that religious communities are making. He went to Tanzania and he saw for himself the amazing contribution that Christians and Muslims were making in that, the Christian church doing more than 50% of education, healthcare, and so on. And he came back, and that was the thing, that was the catalyzing moment that started the World Faith's development dialogue. So the question, I think, facing religious communities today is how can we show the relevance of faith if we are only open to giving help to our own friends? In what way are we making a contribution to the human family? And I was only meditating upon this a couple of days ago when I was thinking about the word mercy and how central it is to all our religions. But I wonder if Europe, for example, is being merciful at the present moment regarding migrants. We've just actually adopted a resolution that we're going to be sending the migrants back to Turkey, and Turkey are going to send them back to Syria. In what way are the nation states of Europe showing mercy to very vulnerable people? And when you think of Angela Merkel, who was being now excoriated, on the one hand, she was applauded for bringing in 1.1 million Syrian refugees, and now the German people are turning on her and the right-wing backlash. So we can see that there are all kinds of problems that are coming our way in terms of the present dilemma. And my final comment, because I want to keep to time, is this. All of us have a duty to bring out the best from our religious communities. All of us are poor representatives of our faiths, but that gives us no excuse whatsoever. We have a responsibility, an ethical and moral responsibility, to practice what our faith calls us to do. And for Christians, and I guess Jews, the call is this, and just as you ended from the New Testament, I'm going to end from what Christians call the Old Testament and what the Jews call the Hebrew Scriptures, Jeremiah 9:24. Let not the wise man boast in his wisdom, or the strong man boast in his strength, or the rich man boast in his riches, but let him boast in this, that he understand and knows me, for I am the Lord who exercises kindness and justice and righteousness on earth, for in these things I rejoice. And it's that kind of coming together of righteousness and ethical responsibility, that's the only way we're going to combat the erosion of faith on the against those secularists who see religion as a bad thing. And we've got to bring out the best of our faith to show it makes a difference to the way we live today. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Lord Carey and Dr. Diop, for your reflections. I want to take the privilege of being the moderator to ask a first question, and then we'll move into questions and answers from our audience. I wonder if, in a sense, I'd like to ask the two of you, are we just passing through a bad patch, or might we be close to, shall we say, an abyss? In the West, we have a growing secularism. In this country, we're going through a tendentious presidential campaign with amazing statements being made on a regular basis that some of us would never have expected, perhaps, to see. 2 months ago, I was in Marrakesh, where the king of Morocco had brought together faith leaders, mostly Muslim, of course, but also Christians and Jews, to look at the rights of religious minorities in Muslim-majority lands. And one of the themes that came clear to me was how was the crisis taking place in the Muslim world with the rise of ISIS and Daesh and Al-Qaeda and so forth. And so we talked to you two spoke about respect, humility, toleration, moderation, human dignity, agreed moral standards. We've discussed the MDGs, the SDGs, the four freedoms, the importance of the United Nations. And yet here we have a growing inequality and intolerance and drone warfare and attacks in Brussels and Paris and Nigeria and Kenya and so forth and so on. Is it possible that we may be here at a point where we cannot somehow pull back? Or Or are we able to just get through this difficult time? It seems to me that this is a really crucial moment in human history, and I invite you to respond. I think we have Andy here has a microphone.
Well, I don't think actually it's a passing phase at all. I think there's a deep fracture, and I think there's a growing number of people who are taking an alternative, non-religious attitude toward the world in which we live and human values as well. That's a bleak statement. And I think it does require from religious communities a respect for this alternative view and to find ways in which we can identify, because as Gadoon was saying, there's an overlap between all these values. We can respect these values and work together. I've worked closely together with atheists, humans. There's no problem because we respect the boundaries in which we are set. So it's not a passing phase. It's a deep fracture. But having said that, I'm a man of hope. I believe we can win people to our point of view.
It's very easy to look at what is happening in the global arena today and play the prophet of doom, saying everything is going to collapse. And this is precisely what some extremists. But maybe let me rush to say, when we talk about extremists, now we are, of course, thinking about ISIL and so forth, Daesh and so forth. But there are also other kinds of extremists. For example, in the US, probably the people killing most people are actually political extremists, anti-government extremists, for example, but we tend not to talk too much about that. So it is easy, yes, to look at what is happening. There's a deep crisis of meaning, no question about it. But probably people leaving right after Nazi Germany would have had the same feeling, you know, that, oh, everything is collapsing. How is it possible to kill 6 million Jews or something like that, you see? But again, and I will join Lord Carey about this idea of hope. And I think if there is a United Nations, and if we are gathering to talk about these issues, I think this is a sign of hope, that we don't despair precisely. We don't give up. There is something wonderful about humanity that can overcome all this actual death, either a culture of life or a culture of death. And I think what is happening in these settings at the UN, I hope, with people of goodwill, is to promote a culture of life, regardless of what is going on around us.
Thank you so much. Let's turn to our panel and or to our audience for Q&A right here in front.
Dr. Diop, I was moved by your whole discussion of religious freedom, but as you've probably noticed over the past year, 18 months in this country, religious freedom as a idea has been stolen, expropriated, and it's being used in the state of Indiana and Georgia and North Carolina as the basis for discriminating against LGBTQ people. It's been turned on its head. And all of a sudden, defenders of religious freedom are people like bakers who won't sell to lesbians getting married. How do you respond to that perversion?
Like, that is a very difficult question, because, yes, I think there is a misperception, a misappropriation of the very idea of religious freedom. This is why I briefly mentioned this is one of the fundamental freedoms. This is actually what I believe brought this nation into existence initially. And it was central to all the other freedoms. It's in itself a compound freedom, like a test. If there is religious freedom, we could see if freedom is really embraced fully or not in any nation. But yes, well, before I say that, yes, religious freedom has been hijacked for political reasons and political agendas, for social agendas and so on. But I'm among those who insist religious freedom is deeper than this right to do or not to do thing. It participates in what it means to be a human person. It is connected to freedom of conscience. But, of course, and I agree, there is really a distortion of this very concept right in our eyes in America. And I can just encourage people to say, reclaim it. And this is a right for every human being, irrespective, regardless of religious or non-religious persuasion.
Lord Carey, I know you addressed this in the past. Would you like to add your...
Well, I want to express some of the pain, actually, because I think pain is a key word here. Part of the problem is when a nation changes, and when you have an issue like this coming up, the rights of homosexual people and so on, the way it challenges faith communities is a very painful way. And having gone through this in the United Kingdom, you see, where within our own church, we still don't allow homosexual marriages, same-sex marriages and so on, while the state around us has done so. So the rights are preserved to some degree. It's wrestling with our texts and maybe going beyond our texts, interpreting our texts is part of the pain we have to do. So I wouldn't automatically condemn those in North Carolina and so on. I think I can understand the journey they're on, and it's actually having respect for one another is part of the journey people here in this country are on.
Any other questions? Over here, please.
Thank you very much. My name is Ulrich Nitschke. I'm this funny guy in the green shirt who happens to be a theologian, Catholic theologian, and I also happens to be very much involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, and this refers to what you said, Lord Carey. I think there's a very thin, because I think that religious values, all what I have listened today to, is so fundamental that it becomes a longing of our people in Europe, maybe around the world, on orientation, on guidance in the principles that we raised here. But if the church, if the mosques, if the synagogues, if the temples can make a difference, then I'm convinced it can only be in word and deed. And honestly, this is what I'm missing in these days. I see a lot of religious abuse. I see only very, very few in word and deed approaches in these days. And I'm quoting your colleague from Archbishop Magopa from Cape Town. He is one of the few voices we listen to in South Africa nowadays, saying what this president does is corruption. Please, president, stand aside. This was the role of the churches in the struggle to overcome apartheid. It was the World Council of Churches who said this apartheid is heresy. It's against dignity and humanity. And I do believe there is a lot of incidences. What ISIS does, maybe what Israel does against Palestine, that need to be addressed as heretical. And that will gain ground, from my point of view, allow me this comment, for the credibility of the religions to become a voice for change. Thank you.
I would agree, and I will actually voice what my colleague and friend Rudel Mar said earlier. Religious voices cannot stay aside, you know, and not be part of the conversation. In some religious circle, they even see themselves as having a prophetic voice within society in order to denounce abuses, you know, challenge dysfunctions and injustices and so forth. Of course, there's a fine line in that, you know, but still, what has happened in South Africa, certainly, there are some religious voices that stood and denounced, and even today, as you have mentioned, what is happening right now as we speak. And yes, this is a vital role, but it has to be handled with care, and I was just going to add, with a spirit that is not that does not embrace evil. So this is very difficult to denounce something but still make a difference between the person that does those things, that person's dignity, and the actions that you are really against. So probably this is a very fine line.
I wasn't going to say anything because I thought what you've said was so good, but I just want to add one small thing, and link back to your question about issues like homosexuality and so on. The trouble with all our religious communities, we tend to highlight the lesser problems to such a degree that the other people say, what did the church stand for? It stands against this or against that. And so what they don't pick up is what we stand for. And the other thing to bear in mind is that when we are isolated in our communities, we are weaker than when we stand together. And if you hear a Catholic voice, an Anglican voice, Salvation Army, standing together for rights and justice, linked in with the Muslim voice as well, then you have strong voices that the government have to listen to. And I think that becomes a prophetic voice in the church.
I know we're all looking forward to a free afternoon. We do have time for a few more thoughts, comments, questions. Up here in the front room.
I just want to say something really quickly. We were talking, I've heard it asked, you know, how can we express our religious beliefs? And it just comes to me that Bud had it all when he said in his workshop, we have two ears and one mouth. We should be listening and not speaking. We can show by our mercy, by our care, by our heart energy, not what's between our ears, but what's down here, and do a little bit more of that.
You're here. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to pose the question, whether we all seem to have a tendency to appreciate freedom of speech or freedom of religion in the abstract, so long as it doesn't pose a threat to something that we intensely believe in. It could be on both sides of the spectrum. Like, I believe firmly in freedom of speech, but oh gosh, here's that guy who's burning the flag or something like that. Oh, well, that's terrible from some end of the spectrum. Or another end of the spectrum might be, well, I believe in freedom of religion, but this guy says he's not going to serve pizza at a gay wedding, even though nobody would ever order pizza for a wedding anyway. But, gee, we got to make sure that guy is shut down. Let's mobilize. And so is there that tendency, you know, to respect these freedoms, you know, so just as long as it doesn't threaten us? And how do we overcome that?
Just to speak very, in a very concise fashion, that's a form of violence. That's really a form of violence. Because, I agree with it as long as it benefits my point of view. That's a form of violence. And I think it's not genuine humanity in that sense.
I listened to this lady here. She was saying, we've got two ears and one mouth. A number of people have spoken. I'm listening, you see. The issue of freedom is such a complex one. Because I think we have failed in the past because we've actually said freedom is important, but it's my freedom that is before your freedom. And it's that perspective that is the evil in the religious argument for freedom. I must be freer than other people, and then I'll be content.
Yeah.
front here.
I'll just speak as loud as I can.
Thank you, Bud. One of the things that I experience listening is that the importance of sacred scriptures in different traditions in shaping culture. But I think one of the things I'd like to hear you address is the extent to which many of our scriptures were influenced by the culture when they were written, and that that's one of the complications now with an evolution of sympathy, spirituality, whatever, for people that, for example, around gay and lesbian, transgender, that's not in scripture, but it is certainly a growing sense of appreciation of who people are and letting them be who they are without judgment. Can you comment on that?
I think, yes, I can certainly comment on that one, and at length, but I'll avoid that temptation. I think within the all of our religions have to distinguish between the fundamentals of our faith and the way we express them. Now, within the Christian tradition, I hope I'm speaking for everyone here who uses the word Christian to describe themselves, is that we, and certainly in my tradition, we would not say that the Word of God is literally the Scriptures. In other words, we would say Christ is the Word, the written Word is a witness to him and to the great journey of the Christian faith down the centuries. I don't know if other faiths would express it in that kind of way. And for me, it's a liberating thing, because you can then begin to separate the culturalizing of the Bible, the way it goes through the different traditions and journeys of faith up to the present time. And Jim here muttered to me, ordination of women, which is clearly a good illustration of that. If you actually look at the role of women in the Bible, in the Old Testament, New Testament, and so on, should that forever condition our attitude toward women and I and others who say, of course not. Because if God has given the Spirit to women as much as to men, then those gifts should be liberated and exercised in the church. And that takes us in a different journey altogether. And I see Ulrich over there shaking his head, or doing something with his head. This is a journey that all our traditions are on, whether you're Catholic or whatever. And to what degree do we, as the church today, consider our past, and how do we make that relevant? What parts of the past should be left in the past? And those are real questions today, and there's no real certain answer that everyone will be able to give, and certainly in my argumentative tradition, we are still arguing all the time.
Well, maybe just a liberating thought about the dynamic within scriptures. Even the concept, you know, and this is not to diminish what has happened before, but the concept of new covenant, I think, is already signals a trajectory. For example, in what was called the Old Testament, and respectfully I'm saying this, by the way, you have some separations of functions, you know, like in the sanctuary, only the priest, the high priest, could enter a certain place. Then you have the priest, and then you have the court of the priest, the court of the male and female. So basically separation. And it seems when what Jesus brought was to say, you know, now is the living, a new and living way, direct access to God, not needed to be mediated. You can call him Father, for example, direct access. So I think that dynamic in itself opens new possibilities in the understanding of humans' relationship with God and vice versa.
I appreciate the words we've heard from Dr. Diop and Archbishop Carey, and for the specificity that we've had this afternoon in talking about real-life issues that are lived out. And I invite you to share a round of applause here in honor of that.